I suspect if a human being prayed sincerely with all his heart, really in a whole-souled manner, Lord, make me a good servant. Add to my wisdom and my love for my fellow man. The answer to that prayer might well be tribulation. Because human beings seldom learn when they feel good. They learn when they hurt. So you would pray with a good heart, expecting some kind of a revelation. And all that happens is you're buried under a mountain of problems. You see, when you pray a prayer like that, you're doing something rather dangerous. You are signing sight drafts in blank drawn on your life. Yeah, when you pray for growth, you're writing a blank check drawn on yourself. Yeah. And I'm sure our seraphim, personal or group, are most ingenious in filling it in. How can we know we're doing the Father's will?
I know I've asked you that question before, Bill.
I really come up every time.
You worded it differently than
last. Well, are you trying?
Please.
Are you willing to admit you're wrong to yourself? You don't have to admit it to anyone else. Are you willing to back up and try over again? Then I think you're doing all you can do about the Father's will. I think the Father's will is different for each person. When Jesus walked with the 10 apostles, two by two, to me it's quite significant. He asked them different questions. Do you love me? Do you trust me? Do you obey me? Do you serve me? This suggests to me that the Father's will varies as people vary, and that the Father's will to you and for you is something different than the Father's will to me and for me. Of one thing only I'm sure, all that the Universal Father asks of a human being is all he has. And you recall what the book says, when God gives man all that he has, then does God make that man more than he is. This is growth. I think the Father's will for you tomorrow is more than his will for you today, if we grow. Sure. Now, how do you go about this with a good sense of humor? How do you seek for the Father's will without wearing a hair shirt in secret, which is about the stupidest set of underwear I think can be devised? I mean, it itches. How do you go about doing the Father's will and not be an ass and indulge in great self-mortification. Even Gautama Siddhartha decided this was for the bird. You know, he went out with the ascetics, they didn't eat, they didn't sleep well, and he said he sat up under a bo tree one night, and he said there's a better way to find reality than this, or to find truth. How can you keep your sense of humor? The earmark of a religious fanatic, insofar as this is testable by standard tests, is he has a strong religious motivation and he has a deficient sense of humor. The strongly religious person who also has an excellent sense of humor is in balance as concerns his religious attitude. Because the religious fanatic is a religious egotist. And as the Blue Book says, humor is the divine antidote for egotism. I think Lucifer had a weak sense of humor, weaker than some of the other Lunatics, because there came a time when he took himself seriously. If you want to serve God, then guard against ego. If you want to serve God, you want to work for the kingdom of heaven. It's not our kingdom. We just work here. We're very small people. Just hourly production workers in the kingdom of heaven. We're not even foremen. And since we are small people, then the burden of the kingdom should rest very lightly on our shoulders. And if we feel a heavy burden, we are bearing the burden of our ego, not the burden of spiritual responsibility. God asks no man to do more than he can do. Therefore, any burden placed upon us is one which we can well bear. Further burdens simply represent the weight of our ego. You recall what it says in the book? You can do many things if you leave yourself out. It's not work that wears you out. It's the wear and tear of ego dignity. You see, again, I come back to this balance. And you'll recall, in that wonderful section in the papers around 100, the Acme of Religious Living, they point out that Jesus' uniqueness as a human being, the uniqueness of the human nature of Joshua ben Joseph, was its exquisite balance. He could consecrate his life to God, and at the same time, be so refreshingly useful to his fellow men. He was so unstuffy. He was diligent as a carpenter, but he didn't. He knew when to break the rules. And when his kid sister came around with her playmates and teased him, "Uncle Joshua, come out and tell us a big story." He didn't say, "Well, now there's a time for work and a time for play, and this is the time for work." No, he went out when the kids were there and told them a big story. If we want to attempt to do God's will, to take God seriously, then in heaven's name, let us not take ourselves seriously. Humor is the divine antidote for the exaltation of ego. Lucifer did not see himself in proportion. You see, we have equipment here. We've got a personality that God gave us. The potential of that personality is unbelievable. Human personality has the sometime capacity or sub-infinite penetration of the absolute level of reality. Human personality has the sometime capacity for sub-infinite penetration of the absolute level of reality. The thought adjuster, also from God, is an absolute fragment of the unfathomable nature of the Universal Father. This is first-class equipment. Human beings are potentially wound up to run for eternity. And it would be easy to fall in love with this equipment. This is where you exalt your own ego. And this is the damn foolishness of Lucifer. But if you recognize, well, I remember my kid cousin. She was getting a lesson in physiology about the intricate construction of the human body. And Ruthie was about 6 years old. And I would have been 12. And I recall at the end of the lesson in physiology, she said to her very dear mother, she said, "And Mommy, are all the other little boys and girls at school as wonderful as I am?" Of course the answer is yes. Everyone carries this equipment. But somehow if we can laugh at ourselves, if we can keep this in proportion, if we can just keep our egos out of the picture, we can do great work. Now or then. The harder you try to grow spiritually, the greater the danger you're on of becoming horribly lopsided and of losing all your practical value here on earth. I think an effort to do God's will is perfectly compatible with lighthearted enjoyment of life, with a very decent appreciation of all the sensory pleasures of life, with having a good time. And incidentally, if you want to serve God and help this blue book, and you go around with a face that's about that long, you're a lousy recommendation for either God or the blue book. But if you go through life with a modicum of serenity, with rare good nature, you're constructive in your dealings with your fellow man. You laugh part of the time. You're not levitous, but there's good, wholesome laughter in your life. You're a walking recommendation for whatever religion you profess. You're happy. And seeing is believing. Jesus was lighthearted part of the time. I think he was serious more of the time than would have been the case had he had fewer problems. But after all, when he was 13, he suddenly became the head of a family and its prime economic support. Madam President, when do we break up?
When you
turn
down.
I didn't like that
time, Bill. Well,
that's pretty hot stuff. You
still call yourself the midwear? Or is it Madam President now?
Why, Wilma?
I don't know if she works with Midwares Oil Company.
I
think that's kind of almost blasphemous, don't you, Wilma? All right, turn it off.
I've always wondered where that name comes from.
Every time I call Burke up, I just say, "You got any midwares floating around there?"
Finally, you trying to do
Years ago, Years ago, when I used to run the Chicago Forum, I used to kid them. And I said, if I ever catch you people taking yourselves seriously, I'm going to pay you the supreme public insult. I'm going to pray for you publicly to your faces. I can think of nothing more insulting. I think honestly, what we are attempting here is a different kind of a religion. It's something divorced from Sundays. It's something which works 7 days a week.
It isn't incompatible with the Sunday religion.
Of course
either.
Not.
All
of course
religion,
not.
Though, Bill, should be.
Of course not.
Yes.
It's good natured. It's down to earth. It's I don't know. I almost want a new word for it. It's religion in action, but it's a sane religion. It's a light-hearted, serious religion.
There's a difference in being a religionist and a Christian, too.
Yeah?
Well, tell us the difference, Wilma.
But Bill said it. He's not for you.
Well, I would answer Wilma's statement by saying there was a very eminent Buddhist divine who made the comment that most Christians are good Buddhists without realizing it. And I would say vice versa.
Well, Bill, isn't there two Buddhist religions in India, southern and northern?
Yes. Mostly it's the fundamentalist Buddhism that survives on the fringes of India, in Burma and Ceylon.
Mm-hmm. One has a god in it, and the other doesn't.
This one doesn't.
Oh.
It's the northern Buddhism that has it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Northern Buddhism has a god concept that is probably the most competitive god concept to the Christian concept of God.
And I'm going to talk about the process for the Buddha. So three couples there. You've got two husbands and one wife. I think the process. Unfortunately, they don't share it. But they're interesting people, fun people, and serious, intelligent people. And the thing I've got to do is to strengthen the bond of friendship to the point where I think it'll take the stress of the business. And the minute I feel reasonably sure of that, there's going to be some books like that. Now, in the meantime, I've started sending in books. I sent in Class Structure in America. The next book I'm going to send him is Psychology in the Promethean Wheel. I'll find some way of getting it in. So they will get used to getting books in this book. And then one day, the blue book will arrive. Well, it's kind of like holding a girl's hand before you kiss her and kiss her before you try to mess her.
Well, if you're speaking to me, I'll be a
sizeful boy. Oh, J.G. Yes, of course. Religion was born in our world when Imbal and Pamba felt the need to worship. And that was the beginning of evolutionary religion. Religion has been helped by many evolutionary religious teachers. Human beings who had a greater feeling for God and for religion, like Anagar, whose religion was the breath of life. What does this mean for God? The first revelation of religion came about when a planetary prince arrived.
That happened many years ago.
One of the departments of his planetary government was the Department of Religion, and was devoted to the furtherance of truth. Remember how the Department of Sanitation got them to make bathing a religious custom? Because until it was invested with religious significance, they couldn't get these primitive people to bathe regularly. But they made it a religious requirement, and then it worked. And she was a compromise in science and religion in the early times. That religion was lost to the world. I think the only shred of a remnant of those days of the planetary prince is probably in the Gilgamesh legend or epic. It's the oldest written epic. It's the Sumerian epic. And it's interesting reading. There is a tree of life in that epic. On an island, as Gilgamesh goes to try to avoid the inevitability of death, and of course he loses out and eventually dies. The second revelation of, well, the light of truth was kept alive in the highlands of Asia Minor by a member of the Prince's staff who bridged the gap from the days of the Planetary Rebellion 20,000 years ago to the coming of Adam. That was Dana, and his human associate, Amidon. You'll recall there's a lake in that area which bears his name, Lake Dana. The second revelation of religion was made by Adam and Eve. And that's been pretty adulterated and pretty watered down and pretty lost. The Brahmin priesthood in India are the lineal descendants of the Sethite priests of the Adamic second garden. Although their teachings have very little to do with the teachings of second Eve. We're told that Agni, the three-headed god of fire, in very early Hinduism, is a distorted remnant of a one-time trinity concept. Three heads. The third revelation of religion was made in Salem by Machaventa Melchizedek. And he did something which has happened only six other times in the history of our local universe. He incarnated in the flesh. In other words, they built a body for him. Just like any other male body, except it was non-reproducing. You'll recall the one thing they can't do is fabricate germ cells. He walked into a sheepherder's tent one day as a full-grown adult and announced, "I'm Melchizedek, priest of El Elyon, the Most High God." And that night, for the first time, he ate material food. That's an interesting experience, then. And he taught at Salem for, was it 94 years? 90-odd years. In the course of which, he taught Abraham. And then, just as mysteriously, one morning, he was gone. Melchizedek taught the trustworthiness of God. Because until men learn that God is trustworthy, there's no use trying to teach that God is love. The Hebrew tradition picks up the Melchizedek teaching and preserved it to the days of the coming of Jesus. Melchizedek's reason, you recall, for doing what he did was he realized that Michael was going to have some background of religion in the people among whom he elected to appear, so that he could say, this your concept of God, this is my father, our father. Jesus made, okay, Adam, Melchizedek, the fourth revelation of God on this planet. This book constitutes the first. I think that this book is in a peculiar way related to Melchizedek's work. Melchizedek was the prelude to the bestowal of Michael. This book is the postscript to Michael's bestowal. And in time, they are about equidistant from the life and times of Jesus. Melchizedek came 1900 odd years before Christ. This book comes 1900 odd years after Christ. Now, speculate on that all you please. I think it has significance. Certainly, in this book, they're trying to resurrect the teachings of Jesus. Now, along with this, and as a part of the interaction of evolutionary and revelatory religion, I think the adjusters have been active in individual human life. The spirit of truth is active. I have met at least two people who are engaged in religious work. One a congregational minister, the other the daughter and granddaughter of Presbyterian ministers, who talk just exactly like your ancients and have never read this book. Now, sure, they don't use the word Marantia and mansion world, but their philosophy of thinking is deeply Urantian. Shocking yourself. Would you like to hear one of these people? Work. Write to Paulina Wall. And there he is. Have you ever written it?
No.
Then I better brush this for you.
I'm not trying to do
it. Well, ask her to make a tape of the discussion of religion with Peggy Amon in my head. Many moons ago, we used a concealed microphone. I knew it was there, and Peggy didn't. And before anyone else heard it, they played the tape to Peggy and said, "Do you want us to erase it? We're just playing fair." And when she heard it, she said, "No, let it stand." First of all, and I think you would have been very intrigued in listening to a non-Urantian talk like a Urantian. She is the hair shirt and the hope of her church. They tore her out because she's unorthodox, except her father and her grandfather were both preachers. And all the teenagers swear by her. And they know if they throw Peggy out, all the teenagers would leave with her. Yes. Yeah. She has a book. I think what Machiavelli was saying was, if you live scientifically, you'll multiply. This is true. You read the Old Testament and read the Mosaic Code of Hygiene, and you've got a very advanced set of health using regulations. Consider the tremendous savings, and you stop killing your firstborn son. This is the common practice. So you don't kill him, you feed him. It's just evidently very nice to keep the boy around in the family. There are many Hebraic customs which made for human survival. There's legislation against certain forms of meat and crustaceans. Consider they've got no refrigeration system there. And this is where you must have to get ptomaine poison. Crustaceans are dangerous, of course, in a hot climate. If you want to appreciate Moses, you must study the customs of contemporary tribes. And then you will see that this old boy was presenting some rather advanced teachers. As we read these today, against our own background, we think they're rather backward. We should judge Moses against the contemporary background. He was quite advanced. We quit once when we get started. You know, I'll tell you what religion means to me. It adds nothing to the calories of life. It just salts and peppers life. It adds enormously to the flavor. It takes a black and white picture of life and puts it in color. It invests life with the dignity of tremendous purpose. It adds meaning to life. It takes away all feeling of triviality or banality in life. It puts value into life. You realize that you're not living to no end, to no purpose. You realize that you're in kindergarten. The head of your life, first grade. And in second grade. You realize that you have the chance, the option, of buying a stack of chips in the greatest poker game that was ever played. The evolution of the universe. You realize that your practices have problem solving down here. And that the problems will grow along with you as you progress. As we trade low IQs for higher ones, and higher ones for still higher ones, the problems will grow as we grow. The challenge will continue. You realize that you are embarked upon a voyage of discovery. Each of us is his own challenge. You realize that there's purpose to all this. You realize you're not an accident in creation. You're wanted. And most of all, you realize that you're the member of an enormous family, the father of whom is God. You're not a subject, you're a son. What's that religion? Means to me. Here. And now. I haven't been kind of off this.
Now, shut up. Where is the connotation of time sequence in that statement?
I think you can take it either way. We know that the paradise satellites will be father and the spirit are each different from the other. The suns are alike. So that means there's 14 different kinds of mass materialization. 15, right. Involved there. And you take it. I could defend the sequence concept, or I could defend the qualitative concept.
Oh, nice. That was my kind of idea.
And I think either one is defensible. I thought of it primarily in terms of sequence, until somebody pointed out it could have a qualitative meaning too.
This is defensible.
Either one's defensible. And it's actually not too important.
It's like
the use of the term pure spirit.
The term
pure spirit has a peculiar usage in the paper. It's used in connection with the spirit emanation of the universal power, pure spirit and pure energy, and we're told that they're identical. Because of that usage, I would avoid the term pure spirit and use the term true spirit.
Anything less of that pure?
Yeah, an adjuster is a pure spirit. A graduate, an ascending pilgrim, graduating from the local universe is a true spirit. He's not a Marantian. He's a true spirit. And if you want to use the word pure as synonymous with true, all right, go ahead, but I think it's a confusing use of the word pure, since the word pure has a special usage. He's a true spirit of the first order.
But then in that verse, a true spirit would connote no Marantio essence.
Correct. As a seraphim is a true spirit with no Marantio aspects whatsoever, in contrast to a Marantio cherubim. Now, an offender is not a pure spirit, if we want to get technical. An offender has mind and personality. Right, and an adjuster is a pure spirit. There's no mind there, there's no personality, there's nothing but a spirit entity.
Well, the example is the word pure.
Yeah.
Well, pure.
No, any more than God has mind.
Well, I mean, he has something to focus on, of course, but not mind. Far above mind. Yeah.
You see, neither the Father nor the Son have mind, because they're ancestral to the Spirit, who is the author and origin of mind. What they think this is something which is ancestral to mind. As the papers point out, Spirit is conscious without mind. You do not have to add mind to spirit to produce consciousness. You may add mind to spirit. Example, a seraphim is a true spirit that I know is endowed with mind and is also has personality. Hence the seraphim would hardly be a pure spirit, because there are other realities present besides spirit.
What kind of mind?
Local universe, a cosmic mind, maybe. Sure, I'm sure a seraphim is a minded being, and we know she's a personality. She gets her personality from the same place we get ours from God. Many of our disputations arise out of semantics. You are defending the concept pure as a synonym of true. Very defensible. Very defensible. This individual is totally post-morantial. See, we're a mix right now. We're physical beings. We have material mind. We're personality. We're spirit indwelt. We are evolving a morantial soul. The morantial soul is an embryo in the human mind. And because most morantial souls are prematurely born into the universe at the time of human death, these seven mansion worlds are provided. And these worlds are incubators for premature souls. If we lived longer, or if we came from a higher level of culture, we'd avoid incubation. We would produce viable souls which wouldn't have to be incubated. The mansion worlds are incubation worlds for the same reason that we have incubators for prematurely born babies. If you had 500 years to grow, you'd have just that much longer to evolve your soul. Possibly. We were told that when God's spirit invades human mind, somewhere in the fifth year of life, this is a conception. The mortal mind is the mother. This pure spirit entity is the father of a new thing, which is neither material nor spiritual, but morantial. And this is the embryonic soul. And this soul grows within the mind as a baby grows within its mother. At death, the soul is born. If the soul is mature, fine, it'll wake up on the system capital or beyond. Chances are the soul has been prematurely born into the universe. And so it passes through these stages of incubation, the mansion world. And it's the differential level of culture on the seven mansion worlds that makes it possible to equalize anybody, be he Hottentot or Albert Schweitzer, who survives. They're ready for him. Mr. Schweitzer is going to have to learn fewer things than Mr. Hottentot. They're equally acceptable in the eyes of God, but they're not equally socialized in the eyes of the universe. Mr. Hottentot does not know that a solid fork is used for solid. As a matter of fact, he's very familiar with knives and forks used with his fingers. And he used with his fingers in more ways than one. Mr. Hottentot has got to learn the multiplication table. Mr. Schweitzer knows it. There's a lot of plain, simple arithmetic that we know that an untutored savage does not know. Arithmetic? I'm proud of you, do. Because we're taught in terms of, we're taught science as well as philosophy and religion. I think you will be intelligently taught, Roman. And I think it'll be quite difficult to copy. Sure. You'll have to learn language up there. Let's say your name is Ed Wallace and you're a Bantu. And your whole concept of arithmetic, as we commented, is 1, 2, 3, 9. That's it. Let's say you're born, let's say your name is Ed Wallace, and you're a banter. And your whole concept of arithmetic, as we commented, is 1, 2, 3, 9. That's it. You get to have a lot of mathematics open up to you. But a grammar school graduate in Western civilization doesn't mean. You got to learn basic first grade arithmetic up there. Now, if you've learned it once, I'll learn it again. Think of a human being as being the carrier of a soul that grows within the mind, just as an embryo grows within its mother. The human mind is the nurturing mother of that soul. The father of the soul is God's invading spirit. That soul grows. I think the embryonic analogy is a darn good one. If the soul can stand on its own, fine. If not, we'll incubate it. We'll carry. We'll extend. What should have happened down here, if there's no time, we'll give it time to happen up there. In that way, the inequalities of life are completely equalized. There's only one experience I can think of that is unique in this life, and that's the sex experience. If you miss that down here, you've had it. The parental experience, the equivalent of the parental experience, can be gained up there. But there's some things you either have here or you don't have them. That's unique down here. I think sleeping may be a fairly unique experience down here. At least sleeping every 24 hours. Well, sleep is not unknown up there, but I don't think we sleep every day. I think we reduce our activities. But I don't think we sleep as much. Yeah. Turkey will be well adjusted to the group. Well, about the time you think you're breaking yourself with the sleep habit, you get off the tire and come to drive off. What do you want to talk about this evening?
I'm not
They have different, they take you in on a different grade level. I look at this life as the kindergarten. And I look at the seven mansion worlds as the equivalent of a seven grade grammar school. And they look you over in first grade, it's got nothing to learn, they pass you on to second grade. And on one of these levels, they'll say, well, you better stick around a while. Maybe this is third or fourth grade. They even equalize that too. If you skip a couple of grades at the beginning, then later on, they require that you go back and teach in the grades that you skipped. So you still have an experience on those levels. You know how you pass your exam? When you've completed a course, they require that you demonstrate your willingness and your ability to teach the course. Then you pass the exam. And if you've ever taught, you know that's the most wicked exam that you could ever go up to. That's the toughest exam of all, to teach it. And I like that. You don't just get E for effort. You also have to be successful, though, with these people. First willingness, and then the ability to teach.
Well, we all want to help some people have a more experience. That could be the prize that you want.
Sure. But I think you get some wonderful coaching going on up there.
You may not do the job as well.
No, but you did it. And I suspect if you are a very poor teacher, not because of lack of intelligence, lack of temperament. Don't you suppose they've got Dale Carnegie courses and public speaking and all kinds of things up there they'll put you through? They left you there? I'm sure one of the things they're going to make me do is a lot of maintenance in the car work. Because I'm unhandy, so.
Yeah.
Very. And I've successfully avoided most of it in this life. And I'm sure one of my early assignments will be as a maintenance man working under a master mechanic in a large factory up there. Not necessarily, no.
They already did in the last position. We just got there. It says there'll always be a demand for unskilled labor as long as it has been home on Sunday.
That's right. Very good.
When I like to read the digest, about 200 is the guy at home is black.
Yeah, I know.
Did you read that letter?
No.
So what I've been saying is that one day I'll come crawling out of the cave and looked around and about that time a female came out of the ground cave, looked around. And the male went so hungry, he said, have you got anything to eat? He said, yes, I can think. He went back in from out the map and he said, oh no, let that stop, they're so busy.
Let's ask the question about a statement that's made. They say they can't give us the exact physical data about the universes because new systems are constantly evolving and our other organizations are temporarily passing out of material existence. The stars are born, live and die. That would be the normal life of the sun. And so, this sun might contract, as it just told us, and you'll recall that at a critical point of condensation, it'll blow up. And instead of a material body there, you've got a tremendous dissipation of energy. That sun no longer exists now. It has become radiant energy. Nebulae are being organized. How many suns are there in a given area? Well, you might have a collision between two suns, resulting in the merging of the two. What's your inventory count on blazing stars? You short one. You got a bigger one, but you don't have two as you formerly had. Are you following me?
Yes. It's the word temporary that counts.
Well, the same system won't reappear, but other systems will take its place.
I
understand. Yeah. Now, when a local universe is settled at night and life, one of the things that's done is they stabilize the physical circuit of that creation. After that time, no more suns will burn out. There will be no more astronomical collisions. This thing has become physically stabilized. I suspect they route energy into the sun to make up for the dissipation of energy in light and heat. If you keep shoveling coal in the fire under the boiler, fire ain't never going to go out with it. Do you folks have some questions.
I don't know, I'm trying to say. I'm just really regretting to know I heard this. I heard it.
I tell you why. To get the most out of this book, there are many paragraphs. You should see almost the whole book as a background for that paragraph. And when you see it in that relationship, the paragraph has a hundredfold meaning as compared to reading it all by itself. I don't know. Sequenced it. Time could be computed. The paradise of long ago was computable on first aid. And may have been. Time was not computed on paradise, but it is on the Havona circuit. Many beings, both creator and ascendant, reckon with time. Each world has its individual time. Question. We do not know that this statement applies to the original scheme of things in Havona, or whether it applies to Havona in the second age.
Well, it is not going to apply to it then.
It could have applied to the first age.
Thank you. where it's so excited and then it's gone.
Let's stick to this first, and then we'll take up that one. I think the only way that time could be explained in terms of the first universe age would be some reckoning like a BG reckoning before Grand Fonda. Now, given that as an anchor point, then you can go back any number of years you want to, a paradigm on a standard day, into the past. And there will always be plenty more room to go back. I can see how you can reckon B.C. in Havana. And, I mean, B.C. and A.D. But you can't have a zero starting point. Because there is no zero. There's no zero. No, there is no zero year in the moment.
I would sell off to that. I don't think about
you could take an event, such as Grand Fonda's arrival, and now you can figure back to that.
A.G.
B.G. and A.G. before Grand Fonda, after Grand Fonda. He was the first mortal to reach Havana. There had to be a first.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
We always said about that.
Now, what's this question about space?
Where do
you
live in Ashland, excuse me?
We're instructed that space is the goal of paradise.
That's what it says. Yes. But where did they get it to the soul? The soul don't mean that it originated there. So I'm just thinking out loud from my point of view,
see what I mean. Let's consider, if you please, the state of the universe before space. Now I think this is the state of the universe in the zero age. I think this space, or not space, fills all things. Outside of paradise, there is nothing except not space. I think space appears, now this is just my opinion, it's not my blue book. I think space appears concurrently with the appearance of Havana in the dawn of eternity. And I would speculate that Havana, the infinite spirit, and space, and motion, appears concurrently. And that this constitutes, as it were, an invasion of mid-space by space. If you want to say, all right, didn't space have to come a little ahead of Havana? We're sitting here. Very good. But I think the beef is being near simultaneous events. And then you have the passing of the zero age and the dawn of the first universe age. And you've got space, you've got motion, these worlds are revolving around paradise. You get the third person of deity, the paradise trinity, the whole business is set up. And of course it never happened, it doesn't seem that. Had space originated in time, then this is the sequence which would have time. Now where paradise got space, I don't know.
It only
No. It came from paradise. Where does the infinite spirit get mind? I think paradise got space in the same way that the infinite spirit gets mind.
It says in the book, that mind is motivated and the source of mind is in the infinite spirit.
And the
spirit is it a derivative of free mind?
Yeah. I think in a way it is.
Is personality in that first unqualified aspect, the first thought, governed only by his own volition? There was some side of personality there at that time, wasn't there?
Free will, yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
I think it is the absolute person we're thinking of there.
Well, I was thinking of the IS, I'm not thinking of a personality.
Yeah. I think space appeared at about the time of the appearance of Havana, or just prior to it. I don't think there was any space in the Zero Age. Now, will that statement stand up? Paradise tradition asserts that the senior architects of the Master Universe contributed to the planning of the Havana. If that's true, then they were present in the world. And if they were present, then the concept of space was present in their plan. Space was conceptually present, whether or not factually present. But this means that the architects are older than the infinite spirit, and that sounds paradoxical, doesn't it?
I don't expect
that
question
from
him.
That's another way of looking at it. Sure.
Well, actually, the architects, if they had the infinite spirit, or if they wanted to establish where they wanted to stand in the Father?
The papers have no comment. I would think so.
But in the first generous days, we had a long notice.
Yes.
Then we had motion in space.
Yes.
Then we had time.
We had computable time.
Then you could invoke, too.
Yes. In that sense, time has always existed in eternal Havana.
Once Havana was projected in space.
Yes. And since it never was projected in space, we've always had time in that sense. You can throw it either way.
I know, but I'm finite, so I have to
I want to hedge with is this. That you can't start counting forward from the beginning of Havana. Because there is no point from which you can depart. Havana is always older than any point that you pick in the past. All you can do is take an event that's happened and count back from that event in the BC sense. And you never run out of years. That's completely. What? You can't count forward, you can only count backwards. Like Creek Canal. Yeah, you can count down the pad up. DC years would make sense in the world. Working backwards towards infinite eternity. You can compute time in the first universe age in terms of negative numbers going back from the beginning of the second age. And you never run out of numbers.
Well, but during the first universe age, there had to be time.
Right.
Because there was smoke.
That's right. But what did time mean to eternal beings?
Maybe.
Who had no origin. That's right. Time has different meanings.
We're told
that even on paradise, where there is no involuntary motion, the paradise mind is perfectly conscious of the non-time sequence of events, whatever that means. I cannot conceive a sequence apart from time. But there isn't.
It's not saying that we would have change in our sequence.
But on paradise, we don't have these.
No.
We have one or we do.
From that home.
Yeah. From the paradise standpoint, though, there is such a thing as a non-temporal sequence of events.
When you say that, then?
I think it's a time-space human being. There's nothing in the papers in the way for those questions. I have a feeling that it's always been. Space exploration started. Eternity events, we mustn't stretch it too far. We must be very gingerly, we must do this very gingerly. It's all right to talk about the origin of Nirvana and the appearance of the infinite spirit. At the same time, we must qualify this by saying it never happened this way. The infinite spirit has no origin, neither does Nirvana. Very tense. But had they originated in time, yes, then this is the way it would have been. Well, we've got to project in the time in order to think about them. Otherwise, we just don't think, period.
Well, in the first universe age, the Nirvana was encompassed by mixed space.
I don't think so.
You don't?
No.
I mean, at the dawn of the first universe age.
You mean at the close of the year?
Yeah.
There was no Havona then. Paradise even comes from this
stage. Well,
so was
Havona then.
There was no Havona then.
Well, when Havona appeared.
Then I think space went on out beyond Havona. Just as space now goes on out beyond the next year.
Space?
Yeah.
So he said it went beyond the dark gravity?
Oh, yeah. Sure, I did.
You didn't think there's a twilight zone in the pool?
I don't need to think of one. I could. But I think his face is appearing. Yeah, remember his period. I think there's always been extra of one face.
I don't think this stays packed even close to the home at all.
Now, but we're the 750 in residence.
Yeah. Now, if you want to, you can take a different line of thinking here. And there's not a darn thing in the book that would support either line of thinking. You can say, all right, well, here's how I feel about it. I think when Havana appeared, there was enough space to contain Havana. And that little by little, space moved on out, taking eons and eons to expand into its present value, which goes beyond the fourth and outermost space level. And if you know how to stand on those grounds and defend it, you can't be attacked.
Yes, you can, I can attack you on that.
All right.
Because instantly you have started a system that has to be counterbalanced by a lot of other things on the way out. And they're not just floating around out there in my space. And I'm speaking of the in and out of us about that.
No. In our original conception, Clyde, in the hypothetical theory I'm advancing, you start out with Havana in space and the dark gravity body in space and very little space outside of peripheral Havana. And then you can expand it. Oh, sure you do. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. That's right. Or you can say, the whole thing was pretty well established. All of the six space levels, Havana, Super Universe, and four others. And you can defend either one of those propositions, I think. I have inclined somewhat to the second one, which was pretty well laid out right then and there.
Because of the architect.
Because of the architect of the Master Universe. On the other hand, there are some very compelling reasons to assume that space is increasing in volume. There's some very compelling reasons. So that this would come to support the idea of growing space from the beginning.
What is the going to do with the equilibrium here? Balance. When you get outside of the force.
Outer space level? Well, you'll have to be in reservoir space. That'll have to be drawn too. You see, the reason we hit this paradox is that we're told that at any given moment of time, space is finite. It's the way an outer margin. And beyond this is a condition known as lived space, which I could translate as not space. And the difference is, it resists motion. So that all moving things are, in a sense, encapsulated. I reason at some length in this study here that space must be increasing in volume. Otherwise, expanding creation would eventually come to a barrier, and you couldn't go any farther. And this would limit the expression of an infinite God. If space has an outer boundary at any given moment in time, but if space is always moving outward in time, then in eternity, space has no outer boundary, because it's limited only at a given moment. Tomorrow, it'll be farther on out. And the day after, so fast. That is the only way I can reconcile finite space with an infinite creation. And that will reconcile it very nicely. I will defend that theory. So whether you want to start Havana out hedged in by mid-space and then expand it, or whether you want to lay out, in essence, the whole pattern of the Master Universe, believe me, you can defend either one of those theories. It isn't too important. Either one of those is defensible.
I think the plans were there, as you say, but we know what that is, I think you don't know.
Yeah. But when did the city and the waste space level start to develop?
Well, I think during the first university.
But then if you go back into the first university age of waste, you will eventually come to the place where there was no development in the first, in the Sophia University space level. But not action. And if that isn't fine, let's go back a few more years. Or a few more. Eventually, you'll go back to a place where space in the seventh, in the space level of the city universities is perfectly quiet.
There's no reason to believe that the woman in the environment and the man couldn't have witnessed the placement of the study of the university.
We're just talking about people
moving
in anybody now.
There's one reason for thinking that, but and that's the barrier of the dark gravity bodies that shuts off.
They
couldn't see through. If we can't see in,
they cannot see this way.
Right. No, but I would defend the proposition that if we can't see in, they can't see out. Yes, I would defend it.
Bill, how many more senses do they have than we have?
But you can't.
49.
The wind is quiet. For them to see, light must penetrate those barriers. And I don't think it does. I don't think.
But
they're better than we ever will. Right, right. But unless they can pull a ricochet over them, I don't think they can see.
They have to go over them.
Right.
While we're on that, don't stop questioning that I'm looking at. Give us your visual picture of the inner belt of dark gravity bodies, which are two of relative same
I don't know how they know what's in there. They may get their information from force organizers or power centers.
How do you visualize a cross-section?
Three concentric circles.
Solid?
No.
I visualize
these, Let's take a cross-section of the tubular gizmo. It shows as three concentric circles, but these are not solid circles. There are many, many space bodies, non-luminous, dark, like a planet, if you please. And I visualize the diameter of one of these circles as being pretty enormous. So that you've got many, many space bodies in close proximity, as the word proximity would be used in measuring astronomical distances, not city distances. And you probably could not shine a beam of light through the width of one of these circles, because at one interval or another, it would be blocked by moving space bodies. Then there's an interval where there's nothing. And then you start to cross another zone. A band, if you please. You're going through the middle circle. And again, you've got many, many moving space bodies at about the same ratio of density, mass to space, see? And then you start going into the final circle, the inner four, yeah. And when they speak of the word density, they're speaking in terms of space bodies in space. So that you go through a belt where there are many more. Then you go through an interval where there are none. And you go through another belt where there are many more. And then another interval where there are none. And they're in motion.